This is Near FM
90.3. We want to welcome onto this platform of Northside today, Kate Nicholas, the author of To the Ocean Floor. Kate Nicholas is a broadcaster, she's a journalist, she's an author, she's a facilitator. In fact, you name it, she's probably done it. And in her first book, she explained how, through prayer and chemotherapy and radiotherapy and support of family and friend, she survived to start a wonderful new career with her books encouraging, with compassion, many, many people she met. Then all of a sudden, something happened. And this is where I hope she could come in and take it now. Kate, I've said all that to just really try to prepare the mind of our listeners to the kind of book that you have written this second time around. What was it like for you, knowing after 7 glorious years, everything has come back even worse?
Well, hi, Mary. It's been really, really great to be with you today and to talk about my new book, To the Ocean Floor, which is about my second cancer journey and really how it became a gateway to an amazing, profound connection with God. As you said, I was first diagnosed with advanced inoperable breast cancer in 2014. And the fact that I'm talking today shows that something amazing happened, and against all odds, I survived. But when I was ill, I kept being given a passage from Psalm 118:17. I will not die, but will live and declare the works of the Lord. But I just decided when I recovered, this was going to become the mission of my life. And you talked about my first book, Sea Change, which was actually the first book that I wrote. I'm now on book number 5. But I felt that I needed to actually express something of the experience I'd been through, including my very unconventional faith journey and this experience of healing. So I wrote this book, Sea Change, which just took off. It was nominated as Christian Biography of the Year in 2017, and my life changed, and I ended up going out and talking to various churches, to Christian groups, literary festivals. I ended up presenting a show, TV show on TBN called Living a Transformed Life. And so I really felt that I was fulfilling this mission of, you know, declaring the works of the Lord. So when that phone call came, it was really quite a blow. It had actually been 7 years, and it was a routine mammogram. Ladies and gentlemen, mammograms save lives. If you get asked to go to a mammogram, please go to one. If somebody you love gets asked to go and to have a mammogram, please encourage them to go, because if it was not for that routine mammogram, I would not be here today. What I got the call to say, the mammogram had identified something suspicious, and it very quickly became clear that the cancer had come back with a vengeance. I actually had 3 tumours in the different breasts to the last time I had cancer, and it was a more aggressive form of it. So it was quite a blow. I think the best way I can put it is I almost felt bewildered. You know, people talk about being in the wilderness. I think it's a wonderful word, bewildered, because it describes that feeling of feeling rather lost. And as a Christian, I found myself thinking about, well, what does that mean if you're in the wilderness? And I thought, well, actually, the wilderness is a tough place, but it's not always this place of devastation. It could also be a place of growth. If you think about it, Jesus went into the wilderness to prepare for everything he did. In fact, the Apostle Paul went into the wilderness for a while to prepare for everything he'd prepare for his ministry. And God gave the Israelites their 10 commandments, the rules for living in the wilderness. So there's a lot can happen in wilderness times. And so I decided that I just had to wait this out and see, wait and see what God was going to do here. And there's a wonderful word, Hebrew word used in the Bible for to wait, called kawa. And basically it means to wait in anticipation of what God will do, of what might happen. And so I realized I just had to learn to kawa and to erase this wilderness time and see what was going to emerge.
Now, you said you just had to cower. I'm trying to think, if I had been operating 7 marvelous years of going, doing all manner of things, writing more books, telling people about how wonderful God is, and all of a sudden, it's not like a slap in the face. The ordinary man or woman, a man with his wife, or even men get this thing now, and how did you not lose your faith? Because it almost seems as if God disappointed Kate.
It's really interesting. I remember doing another radio interview, actually, when an interviewer said to me, when I talked about my first book, and they said, it's really strange. They said, it almost sounds as if cancer's been a gift. I thought, what a strange thing to say to me. But it really, really challenged me and made me think. And I thought, actually, when I look back, I'm saying, of course, I wish I hadn't had cancer. I'm saying, my poor family, my husband and my 2 children have been through so much. I can see how it's kind of aged my poor husband. But can't wish away everything that came with it, because what was so extraordinary about my first cancer journey was how God took a situation that was really quite awful and actually used it to his purpose. I changed career completely afterwards. Once I'd recovered, he opened all these doors for me to kind of reach people and to not only talk about my own story, but to come alongside people who were going through this themselves, and to really support people and pray for people, reassure people. So I had this feeling that even though this was an awful situation, and I really found myself struggling with the fact I was here again, that he was going to do something through this. And he did. And he did. That was the amazing thing, because what happened is I started chemotherapy very quickly. And within about a week and a half of starting chemotherapy, I got desperately ill. I got sepsis. I had sepsis and I was taken into hospital and I was very, very ill indeed. And on one of the darkest days of that journey, it felt as if, the best way to describe it is if I was sinking beneath the waves. And I had, in what I call my ocean floor experience, I had an extraordinary sense of the presence of God beyond anything I'd ever experienced before. An extraordinary encounter. It's quite interesting as a writer, because I think it's what you call an apathetic experience. In other words, it's an experience that goes beyond words, which is quite a challenge for a writer. When I tried to express what this feeling was like and what this experience was like, I actually found myself, my prose, I'm not a poet, but my prose began to meld into poetry, because words began to sort of take on unfamiliar forms and unfamiliar patterns. I tried to express something of this extraordinary experience. And when I began to recover from that first experience, it was only literally in the first couple of weeks, I began to suffer from what I could almost call an intense nostalgia for this intensity of this encounter I'd had. And so I began to explore this, and I wanted to understand more about it. And I was led on this, really, this journey of growth, this journey of exploration. I don't know if whenever you're ill, I don't know about you, but I find people always give you things to read. It might be magazines, it might be books, things to keep you occupied. And I found that my friends were giving me books, and they all related to a contemplative tradition which goes right the way back to the dawn of Christianity, to Apostle Paul, to the desert fathers, the kind of monks who went into the desert, to the wilderness, to try and kind of come closer to God. The tradition that actually then was very taken up by the medieval mystics and even some modern masters like John Mayne and B. Griffiths. And as I read, I began to see that these traditions were pointing towards something, this experience that I'd had. I began to recognise something of this experience. It was extraordinary as I went through this. But it was a very, very different tradition than anything I'd experienced, I must say. So I think, Mary, I think you've already worked out, I'm a bit of a raging extrovert, and I love being part of my church family. I'm on the ministry team of the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul in Oney, Buckinghamshire, which is where Amazing Grace is written, and I love being part of the church. But these traditions were really pointing towards slightly more introverted side of one's personality, and a tradition that sought God in solitude and in stillness. That wonderful, it points that wonderful passage in Psalm 46:10, you know, be still and know that I am God, which was very quite an alien concept to me, I think, really.
You know, this is just marvelous. So then in that stillness, you were still in a lot of pain. You've come through the first bout of chemotherapy. How did you compose your writing? Did you make, were you able to make notes of what was going on? Because obviously this latest book is a compilation of all your experiences, and you have been brutally honest to people because you didn't want to leave any stones unturned.
Yeah.
So how?
Well, I thought it was really, really important to be authentic about this. And I don't, you know, I don't pull any punches in terms of my struggles that I did have at times. There was at one point I began to slip a bit into depression, which I talk about. What I did is I actually recorded, because I wasn't really up to writing, I recorded on my phone contemporaneously with everything going on, because I felt it was really important to capture the immediacy of the moment. So I had a little app, a little app on my phone, and I just literally talked to it. Sometimes when I look back at it, I was thinking, that's extraordinary, that's incredible. You know, and other times I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. But it was really important that I captured that immediacy. And so when I went back through and started to try and write this, I had that sense of intensity was captured there and then. And I thought that was really important. And I do actually, I've always written journals, and I think it's so important to try and capture something at the time, because it's very hard to look back and imagine how you felt at that particular time.
Right.
And to give an authentic account, I thought that was really important. So, yeah, that's what I did. It's really interesting, this whole idea of... One of the things that really struck me when I was going through this was we often talk about battling cancer, don't we? It's one of these phrases that's used. And I think that, you know, I think it's because it gives us a sense of agency in a situation for us that's really outside, out of our control. But I felt that what my ocean floor experience and these traditions were pointing towards was because almost the power of surrender, embracing the situation I found myself in, which sounds strange, but critically to pray, thy will be done, and to actually mean it. I wonder how many times we pray, thy will be done, but then think, but yes, but God, can you do it my way? And I felt that I was being challenge to pray this and to recognize that his power is made perfect in weakness. And so there was very definitely this journey that I was on was really from a kind of very extrovert, active life, period of life, towards a more introverted time with God in solitude and actually embracing the mystery. It's really interesting. I've always been a real rationalist. I'm an ex-current affairs journalist, and I've studied theology. But I think what this tradition was pointing towards, and my experience was pointing towards, was an encounter with God that really goes beyond reason. One of the things that I was pointed towards when I was doing on this journey was Christian meditation. Now, I think most of us tend to associate meditation more with the East, and I certainly have done because I spent a lot of time traveling in Southeast Asia. I struggled a bit with this idea to begin with of Christian meditation, but began to realize that actually the type of meditation that was proposed by people like the Desert Fathers was very different to the kind of Eastern meditation. It didn't focus on the self and things like your breath. It focused on experiencing the presence of God in stillness. So rather than seeking nothingness, you're seeking God. And it's incredibly powerful. And I think it's there's an incredible guy called B. Griffiths who wrote a book called The Marriage of East and West. He was a Benedictine monk who went out to India and established a Christian ashram, which is quite an extraordinary concept. But he has written a lot about Christian meditation. And he said that he thinks in the West we're so rationalist that we've lost something of this more intuitive connection with God and the ability to embrace the mystery of God. And he understood that difference between Eastern meditation and Christian meditation. And I explore in the book, I explore my experiences in, there's some of them quite amusing experiences with Christian meditation. And I also provide a whole series of resources. I list all the resources that I use when I was on this journey so that other people can also try and explore. But it's really powerful. There's a guy called Richard Rohr, he's actually a Franciscan, and he wrote a book called Falling Upwards. And in this book, which is incredible and I recommend, he talks about having two halves of our faith life. The first part is about control. It's about establishing ourselves. If you think about our lives to begin with, we're about establishing ourselves, and it's about controlling our environment. He says the second half of our life and the second half of faith life is more about accepting some of the paradox of faith and being able to live with some of the uncertainty, including the uncertainty of whether healing will happen, and being able to embrace the mystery. And really, I think that what my ocean floor experience and this encounter and the subsequent journey of exploration was pointing towards is this second half of life faith.
Interesting, totally mind-blowing. Now, I was before I asked this question about the title of your book. In your writing this, obviously you were writing it, you recorded it, you wrote it, and you almost like in the last book you said you knew God has said, you know, Psalm 118 verse 17, I believe, you know, I should not, but this time he didn't give you a scripture, so you had to be totally surrendered and be still in him. Is that what I'm getting from you? And what you're saying to people, there are going to be situations you're going to find in life, and he may not even give you a word. You're going to have to trust him on a day-to-day basis in a way you've never trusted him before, because now it's about meditation. You were not waiting for the word, I will live or not die, to declare. Those things were not the things. This now is the second bout. And meditation and being still, being out of your own character to maybe where God wants you. I think what I'm getting from you, almost like a new Kate was formed in this deep pain, crafted, will I say, molded.
It's certainly been a remarkable journey of growth. And I think, yeah, it's actually interesting. I was given a passage at the beginning, which is actually from Jeremiah 29:11. It was, I have plans to prosper you, not harm you, plans to give you hope and a future. But at various points throughout my journey, I could have realized that actually that doesn't necessarily mean a future here and now. That might be a future eternally. So it wasn't a promise of healing necessarily. And so it was a different kind of promise from before. I think there is real power in finding God in the stillness at the center of the storm. I think there is something very powerful about when we go beyond our own ability to control, when we reach the end of our own resources. One of the amazing things about the Christian religion is that we have in Jesus a God who has actually suffered, who has actually suffered all that mankind could possibly throw at him, and actually has suffered death, was buried, was rose again, but has experienced grief, has experienced pain, and actually comes to meet us in our suffering. And I think this is what I experienced, was that in the midst of this storm, I was being led on a journey into the stillness at the center, which I think we can all find. And in that center, in the stillness at the center, there he came to meet me, which was extraordinary. And I think it's not just a self-indulgent thing either, this whole idea of Christian meditation and finding stillness, because I found that the deeper I went into this stillness and the deeper I went into trying to experience God, it changed the way I saw the world. I found that when I was able to come out of isolation, I did spend a lot of time in isolation during that period because I had cancer the second time during the pandemic. So I spent a lot of time in isolation rooms. So it kind of it encouraged me to cut down this route of isolation and solitude. I found that when I emerged from that, I saw the world slightly differently. I found when I was out in nature, whenever I was well enough, I live in the country and I'd hoddle up the lane. And I looked around me and there's the Celtic Christians talk about seeing evidence of God's character in his creation in nature. And I just found myself thinking, in him we live and move and have our being. He's all around me in his senses, all around us. And I think one of the most powerful things was on the hospital wards. I write a lot about this because I talk to a lot of the NHS staff about their experience of the pandemic, and I tell a lot of incredible stories of the NHS staff and how they experienced the pandemic and their incredible courage and bravery and compassion through it. And as I looked around me and I listened to the stories of the staff and also met other people who were going through treatment and seemed to have the most extraordinary kind of light within them, I realised looking around me that I was being granted glimpses of the kingdom. It was as if I could see Christ's compassion at work there in the hospital wards, which was extraordinary, really. So I think it's almost as if in going deeper into this time of stillness and meditation and solitude, you come back out into the world being able to see more clearly. And I think it is, you're not meant to hold on to that time. I think it's a bit like the transfiguration, the mountaintop moments. You have to come back down the mountain again. But I think there's something very powerful. You know, there's a reason why, you know, the history, the church has got a long history of the contemplative traditions complementing the life of the church, because, you know, Christianity is fundamentally a collective religion. You know, we are the body of Christ, so we're meant to come together, but that can be complemented by this time of just being alone with God. You know, closing, doing as Jesus said, closing the door, going and praying to your Father who is unseen, you know, spending time alone with him in stillness and silence, just listening to him. And actually I think that equips us in the most incredible way to see the world through fresh eyes.
But obviously that was given to you. In this book you reveal those experiences. Kate, we're so grateful to have you here. Tell us, please, how you derived this title, To the Ocean Floor.
Well, it's very much, it describes the experience. It was the only way I could describe the experience. I don't know if you've got time for me to read a tiny bit of it, which might explain it a bit more.
Yes, please.
Yeah, so I'll just read this just a little bit. And this is where I was trying to explain something about first experience I had when I had sepsis. I'm vaguely aware of being wheeled down through the labyrinthine corridors of the hospital to the acute medical unit, where I'm placed in an isolation room. As the door closes, I once again descend, down through the waters, away from the light, slowly, gently, until my limbs settle on the distant ocean floor. Swaddled in the stillness of the deep, enveloped in silence, all conscious thought ebbs away on the tide. I bathe in the stillness, and silence permeates my soul. Lulled by the invisible rhythm of the depths, time loses its meaning. Dreams meld with reality as I rest on the far sea bed, until gradually, in that liminal space, I begin to sense something other, the numinous, a presence vast and uncontained, indefinable but tangible, an encounter with something endless and eternal there in the pressing water, and together we wait in silence, rocked in the arms of the deep. I'm forced to simply be, deep down on the ocean floor, beyond thought, utterly still, surrendered to something ancient, beyond time. All striving ceases, I lie in his embrace.
Wow, that is so beautifully... It captures so many parts of our heart. Now, if I was to ask you, who do you think should be reading this book, apart from the obvious? which is those with breast cancer?
I would say it's basically a book, I think, for anyone who's looking for reassurance, who maybe hoping it will reassure people who may have been wondering where God is in the middle of their own challenges. It doesn't have to be health challenges. But I think it provides a lot of reassurance to people that, you know, when we go through challenges, he is there. And I'm also hoping this book will encourage a lot of people to just actually take some time and spend some time in stillness and to spend time wondering and to know that he is God, you know, in the deepest core of our being. It's quite interesting. I talk in the book about the fact that a lot of these traditions come out of the monastic tradition. And so you have people like John Mayne, who's a Benedictine monk, says you should spend 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening. My kind of response to that is, well, I bet they didn't have a teenager to try and get out the door in the morning. You know, they're living a very different kind of life. So I think even if you can spend 5 minutes, in the day to simply just be still, just spend some time, just being still and just kind of bathing in that wonder that he is God. And I do actually give some very, very simple kind of guidance on how you can do that very simply in the book itself. And I also list some kind of resources that I used. And there are lots of resources out there, but some resources that I used, which are been very, very useful. And so one of the things I look at is what's called centering prayer, which is very simple, which is basically about taking a word which it's an intention for you, saying it's a symbol of your intention to just be still for a moment and allowing yourself to close your eyes, be still, just begin to relax, allow thoughts to drift, and actually just try and center your focus and attention on the presence of God. And your mind will wander, always will. You'll start thinking about what you're going to do after this, what you're going to do tomorrow, whether you've left the iron on. But every time your mind wanders, you just simply use that word to bring yourself back to focus. And it enables you to find that stillness and to go into that depths of that peace and that depths of his presence. So there's kind of instructions there on how to do that. And it's really simple. And I've now built it into my life. And I must say, it has just been such a blessing to me. And it has just deepened my relationship with God so much. I still spend a lot of time in the church. I love singing. I love being part of corporate worship. I love being part of my church family. But it's just a compliment to that. And it's just really deepened my faith and it's deepened my relationship with God. So, yeah, I think what I would say about the book is, ultimately, it deals with quite a difficult subject, but ultimately, it's a very hopeful book. It's a very positive book. It's a very upbeat book in many ways. You know, my journey was not easy. And it did take me to the border of death. And there is something else incredible that happens in the book, which I'm not going to tell you about because you have to read the book.
Right. Where can we purchase this book, please?
Any Christian bookshop. You can buy it online. Also, go and have a look at my website, katenicholas.co.uk. And there are links on there which take you to online bookshops where you can get it very easily. It's on Amazon. It's on Christian booksellers like Eden and Aslan. So there are links on my website, katenicholas.co.uk, you can get to very easily. And you can also find out about my other books there as well, including Sea Change, which tells the story of my first cancer journey and my rather unconventional faith journey. And also I've got a blog there called Faith, Life and Cancer as well, which is my continued reflections.
Right. Listen, Kate, it's been brilliant. We've come to the end of the programme and it's just been brilliant just to listen to you. And I'm sure most listeners would like to know you've survived a second time and you're cancer-free and you're free to move again. Am I right?
Thank the Lord, I'm in remission once again, amazingly. I had 2 years of treatment to get me there, but I am once again in remission and trying to live each day and make the most of each day and continue declaring the works of the Lord.
Listen, thank you so much, Kate Nicholas. To the ocean floor, we must all get that. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Ha! Hi, and welcome back to International Writers Network. Now, last time we had Kate Nicholas, and she was telling us about her lovely book and the inspiration between that happened there to get her to write this the new book, which was To the Ocean Floor. Now, she also mentioned at that time, I wanted to get her mind on how she wrote her book. And she said there was a training course that she does run. So we want to give Kate all the time to talk about how she formulated this training course and the benefit. Now, I've been seeing testimonies of people who attended the course and has actually written their own book, their own story. So let's talk to Kate and she'll give us all that we need to know about writing our own story. Hi, Kate. You're welcome to the platform again.
I'm Mary. It's really great to be back with you again. Thank you.
Listen, Kate, you've written books and you're just amazing how even you were telling us last time that you used to record some of these things to make sure you got the thing. Going through cancer twice and putting down your stories, many are, I wouldn't say envious, but would love to say there are things that I know that I want to write. And you've produced this course. Do you want to tell us about the history of the whole thing and how we can get involved?
Yes, yeah, so how I came to do this. Well, I think one of the first things to say is, you know, I started off writing other people's stories. So I was a journalist for many, many years. I was a current affairs journalist, current affairs editor, and then I went on and I worked with a charity called World Vision, and I was running all their global communication. So I was always telling other people's stories. And I also sort of somehow thought it'd be quite easy to tell my own story, but I actually realised that actually it's quite hard to tell your own story because it's quite hard to be objective about it. As I said in the last interview, you know, the reason I actually wrote my own story is because I was going through cancer and I really wanted to leave something behind for my children. And I started kind of putting together photograph albums, but they only show what you look like. They don't show how you saw the world, how what you believed, how you experienced the world. And I realized for that you need words. And so I actually, when I was going through this, I came up with this idea of a soul story. Now, depending on what your kind of beliefs are, what you believe to be a soul may be different. But this idea that we have a part of ourselves that actually is about our experiences, it's about the way in which we've seen the world, the way in which we've experienced the world through all of our senses. It's what philosophers call our qualia. It's something which is quite hard to put into words, but it's our own unique perspective on the world. And I came up with this idea, the soul story. For Christians, that's very much about how you've experienced God, and how you experience God working through your life. And that's really the story I've been telling in my own books, in Sea Change, which is my memoir, and then more recently in To the Ocean Floor. But exactly what you just said to me happened. I was doing a talk, and I was talking about my own journey and my own story, and a lady got up at the end and said, I'd love to be able to do what you do, but actually you've done, and actually be able to map out my own story and understand it and then be able to share it with other people, but I don't know where to start. And that's where I got the idea of the course from. I heard so many amazing stories because I've been very blessed. I've been around talking at many different organizations, to literary festivals, churches, various groups. And I'm always so staggered by the stories I hear when I start talking to people after I've done my bit. There are so many incredible stories out there. You don't have to have a life of high drama to have an amazing story to tell, because each of us sees the world differently. Each of us experiences the world differently. Each of us experiences God differently if we look at it from a faith perspective. So this whole idea of it actually began as a book. It began as a book called Soul Scribe, which is a guide to how to understand and share your soul story. And what I did is I took people through the kind of process I'd been through when I wrote my memoir, Sea Changed. And I draw on scripture for this. There is a faith perspective to it, scripture, but also developmental psychology to take people through the different stages of their life. asking them questions for reflection, and quite deep reflection, about how they've experienced the world and how they've experienced God, if they have faith. And the idea is I take people through this, and I provide templates to help people map out their story, and then provide them with the kind of tools that professional communicators use to help them share their story in a way that really engages people and inspires people. And the whole idea of this is that it's you don't have to be an author to enjoy and appreciate and use Soulscribe, the book. It's very much for if anyone wants to share their story with their family, their friends, their community. And it's more about verbally sharing, really. But having brought the book out, I then started being contacted by people who said, well, actually, we'd really like to do what you've done and actually write a book as well. And so I decided, it was actually during COVID, I had quite a number of people coming to me and saying, we'd really like your help on how to actually write our story, our soul story. And of course, a lot of people, I think, during lockdown, a lot of people had more time on their hands. And I think it was a wonderful time where many people had the space to look back. If they were key workers, like my husband, they had the space to look back. And many people have thought for many years, oh, I'd like to write a book. And finally, the time seemed to have come. So the whole course began as a series of Zoom workshops. That was how it all began.
To me, this is just an amazing, amazing thing. So first of all, it was your story. Then you compiled a book, like a workbook that people can get through. And then people were saying, listen, we still need more. We want to be able to do what you've done. And then you started, you said during COVID, I mean, this is an amazing achievement during COVID, by the way, congratulations, that people even attend Zoom. And how long was the course for? And first of all, maybe I should go back a little bit to that. What did the course cover?
Well, this one I can go to get into a bit more detail now, because the course was actually four Zoom sessions. And there were 90-minute Zoom sessions, and with them came downloadable templates, and I gave PDFs, etc., of various kind of materials. And the idea was that it was a bit like I took people through the entire process from understanding your readers through to being published at the outset of their journey, because I wanted to equip people with all the lessons that I'd learnt the hard way. All the lessons, because I actually wrote Sea Changed. I didn't intend for it to be published. I actually wrote it originally for my children. And then something amazing happened and I survived, and it did become a published book. It actually was nominated as Christian Biography of the Year in 2017. For a while, it was a bestseller. And I wrote a book without having done all the research beforehand. And when I did get a publisher, and I'm very blessed to get a publisher, I then had to go back and redo an awful lot of work on it to get it to the point where it actually was a publishable manuscript. And so I thought, I wish I'd known all that before I started writing. So I worked on the basis that I wanted to equip people with all the information at the beginning of their journey, so they knew what the journey would involve. And they wouldn't have to kind of correct mistakes as I did later on. But of course, having done that course, people then wanted to come back and they wanted to kind of revisit some of the information again as they got to the various stages of their journey. And this workshop format didn't really allow for that in quite the same way. And there was another factor that's led to its development, was that I then, of course, was diagnosed with cancer for a second time. And I was no longer able to actually do the workshops. I wasn't well enough. But I still had people contacting me. So what I decided to do, and I did it before really chemo hit me really badly, is I recorded a downloadable kind of on-demand course covering all the course content, in fact, a bit more. And it's now available in 6 on-demand sessions with downloadable templates, downloadable PDFs, etc. And so I thought that way, even if I was ill, people could still access this. And not only could they access it once, but they could access it repeatedly and go back and revisit elements of it and revisit various different components as they went through the course. So that's what I've wanted to wear, what it's got to now. So it's actually fully on demand on my website, which makes it a lot easier for people.
Right, so it's people do it at their own time, or is it scheduled?
Yeah, people can do it on their own time, absolutely. I still say to people, I think you should try and do the whole thing once to begin with, so you know exactly what to look for as you're writing. Silly things like endnotes. If you're writing your own story, a non-fiction narrative, then inevitably you're going to be drawing on certain sources. You may quote certain sources. I didn't know enough about the whole copyright law in order to know exactly what I need to do in terms of giving credit. It's a lot easier to do it as you're writing, and I provide, for example, instructions on this, and I provide templates to enable you to track all of your different kind of endnotes and credits as you go through. So actually, if you know that at the outset, you don't have to go back and revisit. So there are a lot of different lessons like this that enable you to create your book in a way that actually is informed from the very beginning.
Right. Now tell me again, Kate, about the sixth session. What does each session contain, and what can they look to learn in those sessions?
Right. Well, the actual course takes you right the way through from the very beginning. It begins with really understanding your readers, because a lot of people kind of start writing without necessarily thinking about who exactly they're writing for when they're creating their own story. It can be seen as a way of, I suppose, in a way of almost immortalizing ourselves. I think we all have that kind of drive within us. What I think is really important is that you start off by understanding who exactly you're writing for, and in particular, what their kind of hopes are, what their fears are, maybe what their needs are, what might them make them go and pick up your book. And then I take people through to looking at what I call the key theme. And it's really the golden thread that runs throughout your book. The reality is we can't write the entirety of our life story. If we did, there would be volumes and volumes. There's an awful lot of our life story that wouldn't necessarily be relevant to other people. And so I think one of the key things to do at the absolute outset is to think, what exactly is my key theme? And your key theme emerges when you can see what the intersection is between what your reader's needs are and what your soul story has to offer. And that intersection point is incredibly powerful. And so I take people through a process of looking at that intersection point, so they can actually identify their key theme. And that theme becomes incredibly important, because I can tell you one thing, editing your own life is not easy. It's not an easy job at all, because you have to be very, very objective indeed. And a key theme really helps you to decide what elements of your story add to that theme and what elements really don't make the cut. So it's an incredibly important part of the process as you begin to write, so you can see which parts of your story are going to be most salient and are going to mean most to your reader and are going to build towards a picture, if that makes sense.
Yes. So give us an example please of a theme that may appear, you know, in an older woman's life that she may want to present to her.
For example, if you look at my latest book, Out of the Ocean Floor, so this was written when I was going through cancer, and it is about, it describes an experience I had of found peace and an experience of God I had in the middle of a very, very dark period in my life. And if you look at the key theme there, if you think about who might read this book, anyone who's really been facing challenges in life, anyone who might be maybe challenged in faith, maybe wondering where God is in the face of the most terrible challenges, is one of the biggest questions we all ask, I think, you know, where is God in the face of suffering? And so that's kind of reader's need. They may be going through their own challenges. What my soul story presented was extraordinary reassurance of where God is in the face of challenges. And this idea that in the midst of the storm, you can sometimes find him in the stillness. And so my theme was finding God in the stillness at the center of the storm. And everything I wrote in the book added to and right. built on that theme.
Fantastic.
Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And I think one of the really, really important things that I kind of get over in this is a lot of people, there are so many pitfalls to writing your own story. A lot of people, for example, tend to think, oh, well, I don't need a plot. I'm going to rely upon my real life plot. The problem is that real life is incredibly messy mm-hmm. and doesn't necessarily make for a good story. While we might spend a great deal of time plotting out a fiction plot, we somehow think that our own is going to lay itself down in a way that's easily accessible and absorbable by our readers. That isn't necessarily the case. So one of the big things that I do in this course is I draw on literary techniques to look at how you can apply literary techniques, fiction techniques, to non-fiction narrative
right.
or non-fiction storytelling. And at the centre of that are a couple of key things which I look into. I do spend quite a bit of time on structuring. So actually understanding and plotting out your story arc and then looking at how you storyboard from that story arc in a way that can actually build a plot. So identifying your various plot points and actually looking at how those map out over your journey, over the story. So I spent quite a lot of time on the story arc and the structuring. And the other thing is, I think that people sometimes think that a real life story, their own real life story, it's just going to be a string of anecdotes. If your book is going to be a page turner, and to be frank, that's the only type of book worth writing, it needs to be far more than just a string of anecdotes about your life. It needs to immerse readers in your world in the same way as you would be immersed in a fictional world. So it's a lot of what I look at is about how you create the texture in order to actually immerse readers within your world. And that involves different techniques that I think people would more readily associate with fiction, such as character development, three-dimensional character development, looking at how you actually create that level of texture in terms of the detail to make your world convincing. Dialogue. You know, I've read an awful lot of autobiographies that have no dialogue in. your story is going to be a story about your interaction with other people in your life. And so therefore those interactions need to come to life in a way. So I look at a great deal of all these. So in terms of the creating of the book, I look at the kind of your readers, your theme, how you're going to engage them, how you're going to structure your book, and how you're going to create that texture and that immersion through various different literary techniques. But I also look at some of the kind of grunt work that most people don't like to think about too much, which is the front and end matter of the books, including I look at legal issues like a copyright and the various responsibilities of an author, particularly when you're creating a non-fiction narrative. Because when you're writing about real life, you're writing about real people, and there are legal issues to be taken into account when you're
right,
doing that.
Right.
It's quite easy to see. I've read and worked with people who have got some very, very difficult stories, to be honest. Inspirational, but very, very difficult stories. For example, stories of abuse, which can be very difficult because you need to be able to find a balance between how you convey that without defaming somebody. Because if you get into issues of defamation, unfortunately, the responsibility lies with the author to prove that they haven't damaged the person anywhere in any way, which is quite complex. I used to be a newspaper editor, so unfortunately, I know far too much about this than I really like to.
Well, I'm glad you put it on the course. Nothing worse than writing a life story and you have to go to court.
I remember the first time I did a media law course, I came out afterwards and was terrified to publish anything. But you have to get over that. It's a balancing act. It's a balancing act because if you've got a really strong story to tell, you need to find a way through that. And while I'm not a lawyer and I don't claim to be a lawyer, I do point people in the direction of legal resources they can use in order to actually ensure that they're on the right side of the law when they write their stories.
Right. That's very interesting, because you just want to write a story and that's really good. Now, Kate, we're coming far towards the end of the program. Tell us one of the things that we need to do to get involved with this, because I know there'll be people out there, so well, listen, I have a story and I want to write it for my children. More importantly, I want to write it for my family. There's a whole lot of things that I feel I want to put down, you know, for my family, especially my extended family. I want to put some context into our family before I go. Especially as one is getting older, even if it's for a younger person who's been given a life sentence. God forbid.
Absolutely.
And I said, no, I want to know. I'm a basketball person. I want people to know why it's so important to just, no matter your age, to go forward for this. But they have a whole lot of things that they have to consider. How can we get involved with your book, with your workshop?
Well, if you go to my website, katenicholas.co.uk, it's under courses, or there's My Soul Story. So katenicholas.co.uk / My Soul Story will get you there. Or if you just go to the main homepage, you can get there through that. Now, the first part of the course is free, including the downloadable templates and the PDFs of all the material. So go on, have a look at it. Have a taste, try this out. I'd also really recommend getting hold of a copy of Soul Scribe, because I think the best way to describe it is Soul Scribe helps you to really understand what your key theme is, what your key message is. Write Your Soul Story, which is the name of the course, helps you to write it. So it's actually about some of the technical aspects as well of writing an autobiography or memoir. Well, I will say there is a faith component to it, because I'm a woman of faith, but all the techniques that I talk about are very, very relevant to anyone who has a story to tell. The emphasis is upon your experience of the world and wherever that comes from. So, yeah, so go to katenicholas.co.uk. You'll find all the information there. And you can also contact me through the website if there are any questions. I'm very happy to interact with people.
Now, could we also get your guidance? I mean, could they have a one-to-one counselling session with you? I mean, do you give those kind of guidance whereby, you know, they have a session after the course? They may need other things. Do they get access to you?
I do indeed, yes.
As a counsellor?
I do indeed. In addition to the course, I offer one-to-one Zoom sessions. I offer different packages. One package, for example, is that there are a whole series of templates you'll be given to fill out to take you through various aspects of your journey, including your story arcing, character development. And one of the packages is I can review your templates and give you feedback. And that's over email. However, I can also offer one-on-one Zoom sessions. And there's also a rather exciting offer for some people who may be interested. My publisher, who's one of the leading Christian publishers, was very interested when they heard what I was up to, because they thought they specialise in autobiographies and memoirs. So they thought, there'll be some good stories out there. So we've got a package whereby they will review your manuscript for potential publication and come back with any kind of recommendations which they feel are important. And if you access, and if you actually action those, you can then submit your manuscript for publication. It is not self-publishing, however, it is a traditional publisher, so there's no guarantee of publication, but it gets you over the first hurdle, which is actually getting a publisher to look at your manuscript, which is usually very difficult.
Right, yes, absolutely. And then what has been give us some of the results of those who've come on the course, because I know that I saw on the website a woman just, you know, with her book, glorious, and lots of recommendations from some of, give us some examples, please, before.
Yeah, well, I'm saying, because a lot of these actually, because it does take time to write a book, quite a number of these are still kind of in process. But there are about four or five people who've currently got books around about to come out, which is really great.
Right, and they went through the course and then they had the sessions with you and publisher recommendations and stuff. Would you recommend that people do self-publishing after they finish your course?
I look at in the course, I look at the whole process of publishing, and I look at the pros and cons of traditional publishing versus self-publishing. I've done both. I published a children's book called Wife of the Wind, proceeds which go to Breast Cancer Now. And I did it through a thing called Amazon Kindle. And actually, it was very, very good. I really, really found it very, very effective. I think the big difference is that you have to do a lot of your own marketing if you do self-publishing. But if you're willing to do the legwork, I think self-publishing can work very well for people. There are quite a number of fairly major books out there that actually started with self-publishing. But I think there's also there are great benefits to having a traditional publisher as well. It's harder to get your book in front of a traditional publisher, of course. But I look at how to interest a literary agent and how to interest a publisher, what they're looking for.
Right. Listen, this is very exciting. It's a real opportunity, you know, to write our own stories the way we've seen it through our faith and through our journey in life, and that's very, very exciting. Well, Kate, listen, we've come to the end, and I want to say, what would you say to people, three tips off the cuff that are saying, listen, I really do want to do what Kate is doing, what would you say to them, men and women out there?
Read an awful lot. Read a lot of other people's autobiographies and memoirs. See how they've approached. Also, I think, try to understand what your key message is. I also talk to people about the power of three. Psychologists, politicians throughout the centuries, even the Apostle Paul, have all worked with the power of three, because the psychologists have found that the human brain can better process information patterns of three. And actually, I think, what I would suggest you do is go away and think, if I got three, what are the top three key things that I want to say about my life, that are important to say about my life? And that's a starting point for quite a lot of the work I do on story arcing. So I think, go away, read a lot, think about what your key theme might be, and think about what the top three messages would be.
This is Near FM
90.3.